Welcome to another episode of the Fitted Furniture Makers podcast. If you're new to this podcast, it's a place where we talk to others in the industry, usually small-scale woodworkers, but often people with growing businesses, and we get to know them. We like to find out their methods, what motivates them, what they enjoy about their work, what they don't enjoy about their work, with a view to learning something and perhaps leaving inspired. My name's Alistair Johnson at Freebird Interiors. You can find me on YouTube. And the YouTube work led to other content creation, including now a podcast. You can find out more at buymeacoffee.com/freebird. Now, members at that site get the opportunity to pose questions to the people that come on the podcast. And today, I think this is a particularly anticipated podcast because we've got Gary Banks from Banks Carpentry. Hi, Gary.
How you doing, Alistair? You good?
Yes, I'm good. Thanks for waiting on the intro there.
That's fine.
So we'll let you do most of the talking, but I'll do a little intro about how we first made contact, you and I.
Yeah.
If you remember, I sent you a message. Well, I commented on one of your photos on Instagram because you've got, 14,000 followers now on Instagram?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it was a bit less than that at the time, but I thought, well, here's a big Instagram woodworker, and I loved your work. And I'd been following you for a little bit. And there was one post where, for the first time, I saw the workspace that you were creating these beautiful yes. bits of fitted furniture from. And I made a comment, which was something along the lines of, what, you make this from that little space? Something like that,
yeah.
which was intended as a respectful acknowledgement of what you were achieving. But you didn't quite take it that way, did you?
No, I think it's like anything. Sometimes you can look at Instagram messages and you take it either way, and I think maybe I was having a bad day, but I just took offense to it basically, and I think I deleted the message straight away and contacted you and said, what was that about basically? But I know, yeah, there was no malice.
reading it back, I could see how bad it looked, and yeah. it's a funny thing with Instagram, and I think that was the occasion when I realized the importance of emojis.
Yes.
So, yeah. Because sometimes I might try to be dryly humorous or something, but nobody knows where I'm coming from if they don't know me. So it's always better to soften something with a big smiley face.
Yeah,
is what I've learned.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know why I took offence to it, because obviously, you know, I've showed the workshop so much. You know, there was nothing hidden. I do my work in there every day. I think it was just maybe I was just having a bad day, but no, something good's come from it in the end. So.
Yeah, we've got to know each other, haven't we? We talk quite regularly now. And we've been saying that if we just recorded every time we ring each other up, we would have probably got plenty of good podcast content
yeah,
out of it.
Or a series.
Yes. Yeah, so we've got lots to get through. So I've got these three questions from members that I'm going to just hold off on a bit, because we're going to start with your background. And then I want to know a bit about how you make a couple of items.
Yeah.
And then we'll press on from there. So give us a brief background on yourself and how you ended up doing the work that you do.
Okay, yeah, so obviously my name's Gary and I own Banks Carpentry. We've got one employee, that's Ben, who's currently furloughed at the moment, but we'll get onto that probably later in the podcast. Mm. So basically, I went to college and learned carpentry. Always loved carpentry as a kid, so that I knew that I wanted to do this in school. I knew I wanted it to be my career. So I went to Building Crafts College in Great Titchfield Street, just off of Oxford Street. And then that moved on to Carpenters Road in Stratford. It was a brand new college. So I was there for, I think it was around about three years, doing MVQ levels 1, 2 and 3, sitting guilds. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved college. It was really good. Not so much enjoying the site work I was doing at the time, because it was a lot of commercial jobs. And, you know, I think I got lost in the company sometimes, even though it was a good company. But you know, I weren't doing the glamorous joinery work that I was doing now. It was a lot of, you know, cutting sheets of ply down and doing temporary doors. You know, it wasn't glamorous.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd done that for a number of years, working with a company called Beck Pepiot. And like I say, a lot of their work was in central London. But being sort of a teenager, you know, even though I loved carpentry, I was taking a lot of time off work. So it wasn't like my main thing I wanted to do at that time. So I left. I think I actually got sacked from them at the age of maybe 19 or 20. And then I got the person that actually sacked me was one of my mum's best friend's husband. So even though he sacked me, he lined me up with another job.
Oh.
But I think it was because he wanted me to learn carpentry, and because I wasn't doing the stuff I wanted to for that company, moved me on to a more second fix carpentry, which I've done for a few years as well.
When you say he sacked you, do you mean that you did something terribly wrong in his
No, I was just taking it. Basically, I'd sort of just finished college, so they never really wanted to sack me during my college period. Okay. Because obviously they invested quite a bit of money with me as well. But it was just more a case of, you know, I was taking a lot of time off work.
So you were demotivated. You weren't inspired by the work.
Yeah, I wasn't inspired. Because obviously I was doing a lot of my own private stuff, like making DJ stands and stuff, like being a kid, just making the odd bits and bobs. So I knew a lot. I always loved carpentry, but it was more, you know, to driving up in, I used to ride my motorbike into central London most days as well. So, you know, when it was hammering it down with rain, I'd get to site and I just didn't want to be there because, the work wasn't glamorous. So, yeah, so basically they sacked me and lined me up with a second fix carpentry company, and I enjoyed that a lot more. So I was with them for quite a few years, and that's when I met my wife. I moved over to Egham, which is in Surrey, and I was travelling from there all the way back over to Essex on my motorbike. So that got a bit long-winded. So then I moved on to another company called K&D Design and Build. That's where I learned all of my, you know, I'd say my finishing side, the joinery side, which I do now. So they're a really good company. So they're just there on Instagram. So maybe we can put a link on there as well. So but in amongst that, I've done veneering, I've done roofing, I've done first and second fix carpentry. I've done pretty much everything. Worked in joinery shops. I've even done shuttering along the point as well. So I've done a lot of different types of work in the last sort of 20 years. But
must be good to have all that knowledge under your belt. And a lot of people come into this line of work from all different avenues. And I guess it shows in what you do and how you do it that you've got a lot of experience in woodworking. It seems to me that you've refined your skills and you've got the tools to match those skills, and it makes sense that comes from experience.
Yeah, definitely. And like I say, I think finding that one thing, not necessarily one thing, but obviously the joinery side, I think because it's so skilled and obviously the attention to detail, I think obviously there's certain different types of carpentry, you can sort of get away with a lot of stuff. But this type of carpentry we do now, I think there's no hiding really, is there?
No, it's finished carpentry, but to another level compared to a lot of people that call themselves finished carpenters.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got your second fix fixing architraves and skirting, etc. But you and I, we're taking care of the final finish, aren't we?
Yes.
Perfect sprayed finish, pre-sprayed, carefully fitted to avoid messing up the spray finish. Yeah, it's
exactly
not easy work. So, why don't you tell us, to give us an insight into how you go about making things, why don't you tell us how you would make a shaker door?
Okay, so first of all, what I'd do, I would have like an 8x4 sheet of MRMDF, which is Medite, which I'm using. I'll put that on my MFT table, which I've been doing for the last couple of years. And the MFT table is like the festal bench. So basically, I'll lay that down, and then I'll get my TS55 track saw with a 3 meter straight edge. Mm-hmm. I'll firstly trim the edge of the board, just get a perfect finish, like a perfect side, and then I'll use my set square. So if I'm cutting an 80 mil strip, I'll set my set square at 82.5 mil. So basically that's cutting the 80 mil, but allowing the 2.5 mil for my track, so I know that it's always going to be the same. So if I put
When you say set square, you're talking about the thing, I always forget the name of it, it's I often call it sliding bevel, but it's not that. It's the square with a sliding.
Yeah, basically. I call it a set square. So, so I will set that 82.5 on the edge of the board.
It's like a stop.
Then that'll push that, basically, you know, the rubber part of the track on the saw. That will then touch my set square. And then I know that when I cut, that's going to cut right through, and I'm on the right side of the track to cut properly, so it's comfortable.
I understand.
So then I'll pull, you know, then I'll take that strip of 80 mil off, and then I'll just work my way through cutting all of the boards, so they're always pretty much going to be the same. So once I've broken,
and would you always clamp the rail down? You wouldn't just rely on the friction?
Do you know what, I did always clamp, just because I had a 3 meter straight edge, and I had enough space on the edge of the board so I could clamp it, so it was just safer. Some, you know, at the moment we're doing it on the big panel saw, which is a lot quicker, but you know, this way still works. It was still perfect for us. So I would break all the cut loads of rails, and then I would sort of get three or four of them at a time, and then put them on their edge, and then I'd start sanding. So I'm sanding, you know, as much as I can, all in one go. So I'll go through the grits, 180 grit, then 320 grit with my sander. So once that's nice and flat and smooth, then I'll flip it over and then start sanding the other edge. So that'll be a process of just doing loads. So, you know, I'll work out how many I need for all my doors. So I'll do all that. And then I will set my MFK, it's a festival trimmer basically, and use a 2mm round over bit. And then I'll just put like, it's like a pencil round, and that will just round every part of the rails just to make it like a perfect finish. So that's all ready to go now, that they're all sounded up perfectly. You know, that's they'll be ready for spray in a sense. So, but then I will then pass them through my, I've got a Festool, like a router module, basically it's a CMS insert. So I'll use a 12 mil by 10 mil cutter. It's got like a ball bearing on. So that'll cut through the sides. So I'll cut, that'll cut into the actual rail, so that'll cut, so that will allow for my panel to go in. So I'll pass all of them through. So if it's a 25 mil thick board, I'm allowing 8 mil at the top, which is going to be like my face, which you see the nice part of the door, my 12 mil, which is for my panel, and then I've got about 5 mil at the back, which is the inside of the door, which goes inside the carcass basically. So so I'll pass all them through, and then I will cut some loose tenons, basically 12 mil MRMDF, that will be to join my doors, and I'll also cut the panels which go inside the doors, so they're all the same, it's all at the same material basically, so I know it's not going to change, it's not going to vary the sizes. So all of them parts will be ready, and then it's just a process of having a flat bench and clamping everything up, gluing it all in place. So, and obviously you've got to be really careful this way, because I'm not cutting this after, I need to make sure it's perfectly square, and also when you're,
so you're not leaving the styles over
I make it hard for myself basically. So it is key to make sure that your bench is flat, so when you're knocking them down, that the styles, you know, the rails are perfectly straight. So obviously, because if you had two doors together, you'd have like a dip or a bow in the middle, so you it's perfectly straight. But that's how I've been doing my doors for a while. I've got a story on my Instagram which is saved to show the whole process of how I do it. So
If I'm not explaining it, they can have a look. I think you explained it well now.
So that's how I do doors.
Did you make a conscious decision to put that little 2mm Arius round everything and leave a V joint, because it's a distinctive look, that V joint? Did you decide that was going to be a labor saver versus sort of sanding those joints flush, or did you just think I prefer the look of it?
Well, it's a bit of both really. I do like the look of it, and obviously I know I've had people comment saying I really don't like that, but I love the V groove in it. But it's, you know, I still need to sand that, obviously, even when I'm spraying through coats, I still need to sand that, so it's not necessarily avoiding anything. But I always find that if you do have them parts flat, there is a chance that they can crack after a year or two. There is a chance that line could crack. So I'm always eliminating the crack, because you can't see it.
Yeah, this old joiner's maxim, if you can't hide a joint, then emphasize it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But I just like the style of it. I've stuck with it, and a lot of my clients like it. You know, very rarely will a client say to me, I don't like that, and can we have it flat? But it's just one of the, just my way of doing it, which I really like, so I'll probably stick with it.
Yeah, it works, and it's a little bit different to a lot of other ways that I've seen, because you're using 25 millimeter MDF. Why is that?
I think it's just one of the things. I feel like the doors are more sturdy. I just always like the thicker door. It just, obviously they just feel like when they're closing, they just feel a bit more sturdy, you know. And I've just stuck with it, really. The only thing that, you know, I think I've done a kitchen before where I've done a corner unit and I struggled with a hinge and it's slightly binding, but I don't really do that many kitchens, but I know the next time that I'd use a 22 mil door for a kitchen anyway. So, but for my wardrobes, it's just always worked. And even because if you look, sometimes my details on the edges of my wardrobes, I use a 25 mil M panel. So rather than it being 18 mil, it just looks a bit thin sometimes. It just thickens everything up, and it's just nice to work with. So I've always just stuck with that way, really. So
Talking of thickness and hinges, I know there'll be people asking which hinge you use, because it's quite a common question for people starting out with concealed hinges, bespoke furniture. They hit upon a situation where the door binds because of its thickness. As it opens, it binds against whatever's next to it,
exactly,
unless you use the right type of hinge. So what is the type of hinge that you're using?
Right, so I'm going to tell you about the hinge first, and then I've got the part code. And so basically the actual hinge has got like, if you look on the back part of the hinge, it's got like three little lines where the adjustments are. But for the, I'm using a thicker hinge basically, and it's got another line which is closer to the circle part, which goes on the front of the door. So I'm going to give you the code. It's Blum part code 71B9550. And that just allows, that actually allows the door. So when the door opens, it pushes it over more. So it allows not for the back of the door to clash with the door next to it. So, you know, I've been using these hinges and they're fantastic. They're, you know, they're, I use them even for 18 mil and 22 mil doors. If I'm it just makes a bigger gap when the doors are opening, but you'd never actually, it doesn't matter how it looks when the doors are open because it just pushes it over. So that's what I've been using for a while. So. And
I think that's called a thick door profile hinge.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, right. Yeah. And they sell them everywhere. They even sell them in places like Screwfix and stuff. I know a lot of places are stocking them now. So,
Okay, a couple more things on your door method. What's the glue that you use?
I'm actually getting a glue. I can't remember the name, but it's from Pro Trade. It goes off really quick. So that's one thing that actually puts me under pressure when I am gluing up, because the glue goes off so quick. I need to be really quick about gluing up. So
okay.
Give you the name, obviously maybe you can put it on a link, but I will
I can put it in the description below.
But it is so from Pro Trades. They're on Instagram as well, so I've been buying a lot of my fixings through them. But like, even if you just call them up or message them, they'll tell you. I think it's their own brand of glue, but it's really good.
I think Peter Millard might have mentioned it.
I think he has.
So it's a white glue, isn't it? It's sort of PVA or similar.
That's correct. And it
not
just goes
a
off
foaming one.
No. But yeah, so that goes off pretty quick. So that's a good glue. I've used that for most of my stuff. So,
and is that? Did you want it to go off quick? So even though it's hard to assemble quick, you know that you can unclamp it quicker.
Well, because I've sort of got a method of doing it now. I've sort of got a bit of confidence in my own ability to do it. But obviously, there are times I have been caught out a few times with this glue and with the gluing up. So, you know, if I'm doing, just say I'm doing like a shaker door, which has got three or four rails going through, they're more like squares. You've really got to be on your game to get it right, because obviously I want everything, you know, some of these doors might have mirrors going in, so then I need to make sure them cross rails are perfectly square and straight, but obviously because if I've got a mirror going in, that it can show it up. So I really do my
And it's harder using your loose tenon method, right?
Yes,
you're not domino. Some people will do a stopped groove and then a domino which positively locates that in place.
Yeah.
Are you cutting your panels to very precisely fit as opposed to
Take off 1 mil on my panels, one mil. So it's just enough for a nice bit of glue. And obviously my loose tenons are smaller where they join going across, obviously because the panels go in 10 mil each side.
Yes.
So making sure them loose tenons are smaller as well in the middle. So
And how do you apply your glue? I'm really going into detail here, I know, but I'm quite interested. How do you apply your glue? Do you just squeeze out of the bottle or use a little brush?
No, I do. So you know the pencil trick where you hold your finger on the edge of the wood and you can run the pen, you know, you can make a perfect line with your finger. So basically I do a similar sort of thing with the glue bottle, basically.
Oh, sorry, no, yes, I do know. No, I
yeah,
do
you
know.
You do know, Alex.
Glue.
You,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
Yeah, so I pretty much hold the edge of the stile or the door and hold the glue bottle, and I always seem to get it like a perfect glue line, but it's very rarely goes anywhere, to be fair. It's pretty.
So do you manage to do it so well that there's not much wiping of glue off?
No, there's hardly any wiping.
So you don't get obsessed by covering every surface, which then leads to squeeze out. You just know
So the only place where it really oozes out was the actual joint part, you know,
the
cross rails. Is that but we basically because I've got the little V groove, I've got a really small screwdriver or a you know, the little plastic packers. We get like a damp cloth and we just wipe it straight through, and we use the Bessie clamps as well, so we'd be able to tip the door up on edge, go around the back of the door and wipe it all up. So
I think they're called K-body Revo clamps.
And that's another thing, obviously, because you know the size of our workshop's really small, we've been able to glue up 6 to 8 doors in one go and just stand them on their edges and move on to the next door. So they're really good clamps.
You'll glue them laid flat on a flat bench, will you? Then once the pressure's on, you're confident to lift that up.
Yeah, it's gonna stay flat.
Seems to me the 25 millimeter thickness with a nice perpendicular cut is probably going to help them stay.
To be fair, if I've done a dry fit before, obviously we always do a dry fit before we glue it up, I could pretty much stand that door up and it wouldn't come apart. That's how it just feels so sturdy, even without glue.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm always going to apply glue, but it's just that way. It's just so sturdy. I love it the way we do it. So, but it's just a hard method sometimes. You just have to be on the ball to do it. So,
So next question: how do you make a chunky shelf, like a floating shelf in an alcove?
Right. So, I do. Oh, I was going through a stage where I was doing quite a few of these. So it's a similar sort of trick to how I do the shaker door, in the sense that I groove out the sides of the shelves. But first of all, we use 40mm MDF, which is not Medite, because obviously they don't do it in that, you know, moisture resistant. So,
oh, is that right? So yeah, is so it's not just, moisture resistant.
No, it's a little bit more. It's a little bit harder to spray because obviously with moisture resistant MDF, it seems to the fibers seem to come up less when you're spraying because I'm using water phase. But with the standard MDF with the 40mm, it just seems to raise a bit more, so it's a bit more preparation. But so 40mm MDF, we'll obviously cut some sort of thing, cut us, you know, slightly oversized. So if it's an alcove of a meter by meter wide by 350 deep, I'll always do it sort of 1200 wide and just slightly deeper, and then that can be scribed into the actual alcove.
But do you mean 1200 or a meter and 2 centimeters or something like that?
So, to be fair, I just it saves because I know I'm going to cut some. I'm going to cut it off.
Actually, that's quite smart because it's just like a half board width.
Basically, yeah. So I just set my track saw up slightly smaller. The smaller track saw, and I'll just set cut width ways. And
that is always such a smart move because, yeah. we have this rule where we make everything 2 centimeters oversized.
Okay.
But then, as you've clearly realized, and I've not quite clocked on until you've said this now, all I'm doing is I'm cutting a length off that I can't use for anything.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a meter shelf and I'm left with 200 mil, I just never use it.
Yeah.
So do you then get to dispose of that at the customer's house?
Yeah, well, like I say, because it's usually cut both sides because obviously dependent, obviously, because sometimes the actual chimney breasts and the alcoves are never square. And this is another thing that obviously if the back of the wall is tapering in, then it's fine to scribe in perfectly. But obviously if the front is smaller than the back, then obviously you have that tricky part of trying to get the shelf in, but it leaves you with a little gap, which, you know, we can fill up with either splices or we use silicone, which is a special silicone, which I can tell you about as well, which we use. So,
but a coloured silicone.
Yeah, basically coloured. So if I've got a sprayed shelf and that's all fitted and I can't fill the gaps with like a splice of wood or anything, I use coloured silicone. The actual place I use is called County Construction Chemicals, and they will basically, they don't necessarily mix the colours up, but I'll take in like a swab of the colour I've sprayed, and they will match the silicone exactly the same as my colour paint, and it's always worked for me. So
is that a place local to you in Essex? That you can
That's in Chinkford, in sort of East London.
There's a lot of great suppliers in Essex.
Yeah.
It seems like all the best fitted furniture and board suppliers are in Essex. Yeah. I wanted to mention to you earlier, we're talking about Medite MRMDF, which I know a lot of people have settled on. That's what I use.
Mm.
Tried lots of others. It seems to be the best for staying flat and not fluffing up too much with water-based paint.
Yeah.
But I've been hearing from a couple people in the industry recently about one that's sold by Stellafoam in Essex.
Yeah.
And it's a Finsa board, and it's got a funny name. It's I think it's Fibropan. When I looked into it, there's actually loads of variations even of Fibropan.
Okay.
But it's denser than the Medite MR. And it's got an even better core finish. So you cut it and it hardly needs sanding is what I've been told.
Yeah, definitely need to try that stuff out then. Because I've been using Medite for so long, because I actually use Mayer Timber, which are over in Tilbury, because I've had an account with them for so long. And obviously because they deliver, because obviously my workshops were at my house and they've got these massive Arctic trucks, but they did deliver to me, which is perfect. So I've always just stuck with them, but it'd be nice to try a different type of MDF if it's making less prep work for spraying and stuff. So it'd be good to try that.
Yeah. Just sticking on the chunky shelves. So you're cutting the shelf to fit as best you can in the alcove. And then on site, you're grooving it with the same router setup as you use for the doors, the 12x10mm cutter.
Yeah, that's right. So basically what I do. Yeah. So if I've got, just say I've got a chimney breast with an alcove either side, and I've got 10 shelves to go in, I'll set my laser level to mark all where my battens go, basically. And I use a softwood batten, 10mm by 12mm, and that will all be made in the workshop pre-done, and I'll count the sink and drill it all ready to go. So I'll then mark each batten on the wall, hammer drill everything where it needs to go, and I'll fix them. So all the battens are all ready to go, all on the wall. So I've got loads of battens everywhere. And then I'll obviously scribe my shelf in the best I can and plop the shelf on top just to make sure it fits. Then I'll take the shelf off the battens and then groove the 10mm by 12mm into the side of the shelf and at the back of the shelf, and then that will slot over my battens. And it's I think it's a perfect way of doing it, really. It's, you know, because I can pre-spray all my shelves, and they're so strong as well. So like I said, the only downfall is obviously if you've got really, really bad walls, obviously trying to scribe certain things in, but like with the silicone, sometimes you can, you know, just fill it up slightly.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear how you do chunky shelves. There's lots of ways of approaching them. And something we've talked about before is how in this line of work, you have to choose your compromise.
Yeah.
Because to get a good finish and to do it profitably, you can't work miracles. And so you've made a decision that it's an acceptable look to get the front of your shelf just spot on, but with a splayed alcove, you may have to sacrifice getting that tight at the back. But
yes.
It's probably going to be covered with books anyway.
Yeah.
I took a decision to make a two-part shelf construction so that I could sort of clamshell them together over concealed battens, and I could fit into those kind of splayed alcoves. But the downside for me is there's then a seam, because one part has a pre-attached, pre-finished lip, and the other part butts up under it, and I just get around that by having that seam above eye level or below it eye level, depending where the shelf is. But either method has its pros and cons, doesn't it?
I think if the client, obviously I'll always explain to the client, because obviously some of these, the walls and these houses that I'm working in are so bad, I think if you explain to them, you know, that it's not going to be quite perfect in that back part of the alcove, as long as it's strong and it looks visually nice, then it's never really a problem, to be fair. And it's not always every house is like it anyway, so it's just the odd one that it's bad. Yeah.
Well, managing expectations with customers is important, and if you've talked about it and shown that from your experience and expertise you do it this way, but there might be this slight downside, is that okay, then customers feel part of the process, that they don't, you know, they're going to be less prone to then be picky about something that's not being addressed.
Yeah, and like I say, and if it's something that they're really not happy with, then we may take a different approach, you know. But it's never that bad. I've then never walked away from it thinking, I really don't like that. Obviously, I'm very fussy with my work, so I'm usually pretty happy with the way I leave stuff. So,
yeah, you seem like someone that goes the extra mile. A little example of that is I'm going to let everyone know we've recorded this whole thing 2 hours worth, and we had an audio issue, and Gary was happy to say we're going to do it again and we're going to get it right. And I think that's a real testament to your desire to take pride in what you do and know it's done right. Yeah. so you might not want me to say that I've damaged professionalism there, haven't I?
We all make mistakes now and then, and obviously we do want the things to be perfect. So even if it's a podcast issue, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it properly. So
do it right. This is a mantra that I'm, since the coronavirus lockdown, that's given me time to think about how I go about things. I keep saying to myself this mantra: do it right and do it once.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, that didn't quite work this time because we couldn't get it right first time. But
I think it's just that we like talking, Alistair, probably. That's what it is.
But I've actually felt a bit of a shift in my approach to work, where I'd got sloppy. I don't know if this ever happens to you. I suspect it doesn't. But I had got sloppy in my work, and I was just about delivering a good product still. Mm. But I knew that I could do things better with more care. And I've it's been like a reset for me to have stopped and started again. And I'm working faster because I'm getting those scribes just right first time with the right jig and the right tool, a sharp pencil, etc. So, yeah, and I found that seeing others on Instagram, and right up there at the top is yourself amongst others, seeing those methods that others use helps me to raise my game.
That's good.
Yeah, so let's get on to the questions from members at my Buy Me a Coffee site. So we've got three questions here. First one is from Rich Holroyd at Truro Bespoke Joinery. He says, rewinding to before Gary moved premises, and we'll talk a bit more about your move in future, I think, with the larger machinery, did he find it more cost effective to order MFC sheets and edge all the components himself rather than give a cut list to a supplier and then break down and edge the components? Or was it a question of quality control? And then I suppose it's a separate but related question. He's saying, any tips for people working from a smaller workshop like himself?
Okay.
And then he says, keep up all the great work.
Oh, brilliant. So I did use, so where I've just moved to in my new workshop is actually next door to someone I was using to break down the sheets for me, edge, you know, do a cut and edge service, because obviously they could do it such a good speed, and obviously, you know, it was always going to be perfect. But I did like to keep everything in house. You know, if I was doing a bespoke wardrobe, you know, sometimes the time it would take me to, you know, put it all through a website, and, you know, you do pay a premium for these guys to obviously break the sheets down and edge them. So it was costing quite a lot of money. So I thought to myself, could I do this all myself? And I was using, obviously, the track saw again, cutting all my boards through. You know, we could stack, being a small workshop, we could stack, you know, at least 10 to 15 boards on edge behind our tables, lift it up onto the bench, cut it all down, and we would use the Festool Contouro, which is the edge bander. So that was quite a good way of edging, you know, time consuming, you know, compared to what we've got now with the big edge bander. It's completely different, but, you know, a small workshop, this worked absolutely perfect for us. So, you know, it was a case of, you know, feeling good about doing the whole job yourself. Obviously, I could sub my machine, my boards being cut, could sub the spraying out, but sometimes you get a good feel about doing everything. When you look at the whole job, you think, well, I've done the whole lot. So, you know,
it's not just driven by efficiency or economy, it's that desire to know that you made it all yourself.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even with, like, with just, you know, obviously with Instagram, I try and put as many stories I can, you know, so sometimes it's nice to see, to show that we're breaking everything down from, you know, straight from the delivery off the lorry, and then we're cutting it all down ourselves. You know, you can, if you're just subbing everything out, it's just, I might as well just be a fitter in a sense. So I do like to do everything myself, really. So just in case there's mistakes, because, you know, I still make mistakes in the sense that, you know, I can have a cutting sheet, if I've put down a wrong digit and I've just got a load of stuff cut from a company and then they get delivered to me and they're all wrong, you know, that could be so costly. But
on their schedule then to get
exactly
it,
yeah. And obviously I'd have to try and obviously I wouldn't be able to just cut an edge, because it'd be slightly different edging, so, you know, the way they finish it. So I've
good point.
That's how I was doing it, you know, depending on the size of the job as well. If it was a really big job and there were so many components and I couldn't quite fit in my workshop to do it, then obviously I would sub it out, but usually doing it all myself, really. So
the thing that put me off taking that approach was I didn't have confidence in A, getting a chip free cut in melamine off the track saw, and B, getting it as perfectly square as I knew. So I used Lawcris, and I knew they would cut it on a beam saw.
Yeah.
Sort of semi-automated, put it through an edge bander. And yeah, well, third issue for me, I mean, I don't actually have an edge bander, but I was never sure if it was worth it. So I'm really interested to hear how you went about it, because I just made a flat assumption, seeing you in the small workshop, that surely he must be buying all those boards in.
No.
Ed cut and edge.
No, I was so putting myself through pain. So the trick was, obviously, we all know that melamine chips out. And I was using, obviously, the track saw with a new rubber, like, not every time, just a clean rubber on the underside, so that, you know, the blade cuts against that, so it doesn't chip it out. But also I was using Festool's own blade, which was called a special blade. Again, we might have to get the code for you, but it's
it'd be good if you could, because you mentioned this before. So you call it the red and green blade.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, I think it's actually called a special blade. I'm not sure if it's designed for melamine, but it actually worked perfect.
I found it hard to find the one and to be confident that's the one Gary was talking about, but I did find one that was about £110 for the blade.
Okay, I don't think it's as much as that. So I will get the code for you, and maybe you can put it in the podcast at the end.
If you could, that would be great, because I've just been experimenting. In fact, I had a YouTube video planned that I'm probably going to park, because I was recommending to people the best way to cut chip-free with melamine is to do a scoring cut first.
Yeah.
And lots of people have advised me to do this. It's not just my idea. And then you drop right through. But you told me you go right through in one pass and still get a chip-free
cut. If it's 18 mil, and obviously the underside of the board, I always have like a cover board as well. So if I'm cutting an 18 mil, an 8x4 sheet, I'd always have the same size sheet, like an MR, MDF board underneath. So I haven't got
into that. It actually
prevents dust as well. So obviously you've got your normal Hoover, but if you've got like a clear space underneath with just your board, so that makes more dust. So if you've got a flat board another board on top of it, it prevents dust. So
that's a trick again for a small workshop, keeping dust down. That's
method.
Yeah.
But yes, with that blade, that's just been working for us. And if it's just it's a white melamine board, we use the Contouro edge bander with the white glue. So if there was any really small chips, usually that glue would take out, you know, it would actually sort of fill up them little tiny little chip. So that's always been, it's always been fine for us. We've always never had any complaints. So it's always been good.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me. I'm sticking around on this question of cutting melamine for quite a long time, but I just had a debate with people on Instagram about this, and a few people were saying not to cut into a sacrificial board. You're definitely right about the dust extraction for that, but they were saying to me that they get a better finish on the underside if they cut down deep, maybe 30 mil, and just cut into free space, because then the teeth are cutting up more perpendicular to the underface of the board, and they say they get a better finish. But it sounds like you've found a perfect compromise with it sounds like it's to do with this blade a lot, that you're getting a good finish and capturing the dust.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can, when you do your test, we might be able to, you can try both out with the photo.
I'm going to have to, aren't I? Yeah, I've got this backlog of footage. I did a Makita versus Festool comparison video. And when I started editing it together in iMovie, I had 50 minutes worth. And that's because I ramble on a bit sometimes. So I was thinking I might have to do it again. Yeah. But getting slightly off track. But the outcome of that, so to save people 50 minutes of a YouTube video, the Festool is definitively better than the Makita track saw. And I might get some hate mail for this. I didn't think that would be the outcome. I imagine you'll agree because you're a Festool man, but I thought it would be a close call because the Makita has a couple of features that the Festool doesn't have. One of them being this tilt stop, where you engage a little clip into an extra flange in the track and it stops it falling over on the angle cut. But what I found was doing a direct head-to-head comparison was that may as well not be there, because when you're doing the angle cut, you've got to twist your wrist to keep it flat onto the track anyway. Yeah. You don't want it tipping up and scraping against that thing. So it may as well not be there anyway. And a key difference on quality was the little cam locks, you know, where you tighten those wheels against the track.
Yes.
On the Makita, it's just a plastic wheel and there's nothing on the other side of the groove, on the underside of the track saw itself. On the Festool, you've got the plastic cam wheel, and both sides of the upstand thing on the track have like a sliver of plastic. And it's that one's the Festool's older than my Makita, but that hasn't worn. I can still grab it tight. The Makita has worn. And what I'm finding is I'm getting play. So when I try and do an angle cut, even clamping the rail down, there's too much play and it's burning.
Yeah, it's burning, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, that was a bit of a monologue there that we hadn't planned, but
that's fine.
I'd be interested.
Yeah.
And so you're very much a Festool man, aren't you?
Yes.
People are going to expect you to talk a bit about Festool. We're going to get onto the next question in a minute, but do you want to just give us a little brief overview of how you got into Festool and why you love it so much?
Well, so the old company I worked for 10 years, where I learned most of my joinery, they had quite a lot of Festool. But obviously I would be using it, but you know, I didn't, because it weren't mine. Obviously I did look after it, but I just didn't really take it all in. Basically in 2008, the recession hit and I end up leaving that company because obviously they just didn't have any work. So, they had to let me go. And I thought, you know what? I need to work for myself and I need to get some tools. Basically I had some tools, but I just wanted to buy, you know, something decent that's going to last me a while. So my wife actually bought me the TS55 track saw. Mm-hmm. And that was my first Festool, which I owned. And it was just, it was a game changer, basically. I absolutely loved it. And since then, I've probably gone a little bit crazy over the years and pretty much have a lot of the stuff they have to offer. So, but I swear by it, because obviously, you know, even with the small workshop, the sustainers and everything are so compact, just being able to keep everything organized and knowing where everything is. It's basically, I think that, you know, it's quite cheesy to say that Festool has actually made my business in a sense, because we've been able to do so many things in such a small space with their tools, and they've been so accurate, they've been reliable. So it's just always been like perfect. And I used to be a little bit untidy and a little bit messy when I was younger, like in terms of
carpentry work.
But it's actually made me be more neat and a lot more tidy with how I do stuff. And I think it's just the whole, you know, the whole sustainers, how it all works. It just makes
well, it's it, if you've got a place for everything, then everything will go in its place.
Yeah.
My work's been transformed by this time off where I've reorganized my tools into a mix of sustainers and DeWalt T-Stacks, and I've even put them into tool foam. And it's strangely freeing to know that every tool has its place, and you just put it straight back there, and then the chaos doesn't grow again.
Yes. Yeah. I love working like that. I have to.
So would you say, just sort of wrapping up Rich's question about tips for working in a small workspace, would you say that's key to be organized like
that?
Yeah,
100%. So tidy, keeping everything clean and tidy, everyone works better when it's tidy. So keeping everything tidy, clean, having the right tools, you know, all organized. Organization is a massively big thing in our industry as well. So
yeah,
it's just organization is the biggest thing, really. So like, especially in small spaces, because you can't have tools lying everywhere, you'd just be tripping over, you know.
Yeah,
just be chaos. So
at least a mental clutter, in my experience, if a workspace is cluttered, then my mind's cluttered.
Yes.
And I can't focus.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to turn it off and on again, because I want to be sure we don't lose audio. And we'll resume with a question from Nick Harvey from Harvey Woodcraft.
Yeah, no worries. See you in a second.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, so Nick's question. Nick's based over in New Zealand. He sent this question through. He says, my question would be lessons learned in business and in joinery. He says, we always see the best from you, which is great, but like many or all of us, we all make mistakes. So which ones have you learned from the most? Maybe one from both business and joinery. And he says at the end, love Gary's work. If I could do half of what he can, I would be happy.
Yeah. So my biggest mistakes or challenges in the last couple of years have been spraying. Because obviously, you know, I think that I'm pretty good at spraying now. But I think it was about 6 months ago, I had a bit of a disaster. Basically, I was asked to try out some paint from a well-known company.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't go well. So basically, rather than me doing samples and trying the paint out before putting it onto a finished job, so basically I had 10 shaker doors, M panels, scribes and everything, and I just fully went on with this new paint, and it just didn't dry properly. It was cracking everywhere. It was all cracking all in the shaker, the shaker parts in the joints. I just had a disaster basically. And the couple that I was actually working for, they were expecting a baby, you know, quite soon. So I was really up against it, and I just couldn't get rid of the problem. I was sanding back and putting more primer on, but I was just doing loads and it just wouldn't go. And yeah, so basically that has been my biggest problem. Is I've been using Particularilla paint, they're a Finnish brand, and I've been using them for a while and I've had no problems with it. So I'd say if something's working for you, don't try, unless you're going to really put some research into it and do loads of samples. Don't try and fix it, basically. So the biggest problem I've had is spraying. So
okay, was that your biggest challenge, would you say, from the making side of things, that job which went wrong on the spraying?
Yeah, to be fair, I'm just trying to think back to any real problem. I haven't really had that many huge problems, to be fair. The odd little things that can be fixed, you know, very quickly, you know, cutting things wrong, you know, cutting sheets and stuff like that. But never anything major, like in terms of spraying, because obviously spraying is something I've learned over the last few years. So I would say with carpentry and joinery, I can get myself out of trouble very quickly because of my experience. But with the spraying side, I tend to, you know, at that situation, I found myself very frustrated and, you know, not a happy person at the time. Because
Remember speaking to you around that time. I think I just happened to call you up, and you were as unhappy with your work as I'd ever heard you.
Yeah.
To the point you were seriously saying to me that you were thinking of outsourcing spraying from that point onwards. But that was maybe just the stress of the situation talking at the time. But
exactly.
did you pursue that at all, or did you just quickly think, no, well, stick
no, so I went back. I actually went back to the paint. So I sanded all that back, the job, and went back to the paint I've been using. And you know, I know a lot about finishing, because even with the company I was working with before, you know, the finishing was incredible. They were getting, so I knew what things should look like. But so I've been using a water based system, which, you know, people would say it's a lot harder to work with, because obviously, you know, when you're spraying MDF and stuff like that, you get so many fibers come up, you know. It's a lot more preparation. You know, I put four coats on my paint, you know, two primers, two tops, and there's a lot of sand in between coats. So, you know, it's very long-winded, but I managed to, you know, I've got a system now, so it all seems to be working right now. But, you know, it's one of them things. I think with the new workshop as well, we are thinking about maybe getting a mezzanine floor. Because it's on a proper industrial unit, I'm allowed to use, you know, certain smelly chemicals and, you know, because obviously all this PU and AC paints have got a lot stronger smells. You know, the water-based system hardly has any smell at all. So if I want to go down that route of trying new paints out, I can with the mezzanine floor, like build a proper spray booth above my working area. So, but right now, I think I'll just put that on hold because I have got a perfectly working spray booth at home, you know, because obviously I've got the small workshop, which is now storage area with all the jobs building up, and I've got the spray booth, and I've got basically another a conservatory, which is like a sanding area. So I've got quite a lot of space at home to work as well, which has been quite lucky, really. So.
And so those three spaces have been dedicated to your business, and has that been fine with your wife for all this time?
So I've been lucky, and she's happy because obviously, you know, I've been able to, because I've got 3-year-old twins as well. So I've been able to be home quite a lot and, you know, mingle with the kids a bit. My wife works from home, so she's home 2 days a week. So our house is quite busy. So it's
so
nice.
Even pre-coronavirus, she was working home from home a couple of days a week.
So we've always had, there's always been people home. So it's been nice to be able to work from home. You know, the only thing is sometimes it can be slightly distracting where, you know, if I've got quite a bit of work and I'll just pop in and see the kids, and then suddenly it's just turned into 45 minutes. I haven't really done any work. So that's the only downfalls. But
okay. So making sure we've finished on Nick's question, he wanted to know about any challenges which have led to lessons learned from the joinery side. So you talked about spraying challenge. And what about the business side? Do you feel it's always run smoothly for you with pricing and scheduling and things like that?
Well, yeah, so this is where my wife comes into it again as well, because she's quite she's fairly clever with numbers and stuff like that. So she's always kept spreadsheets, and, you know, she's always done my VAT returns, my taxes and everything for me. So, you know, in terms of, you know, she motivates me in the sense that when we're trying to do quotes and stuff like that, she would have it all set out properly. And, you know, so it's basically idiot proof for me, really. So, but I think in that case, if it was me taking over and doing all the business side and the paperwork side, I'll be sitting here for probably an hour talking about how things would go wrong, because I'm good at drawing. Well, I'm fairly good at drawing, you know, I'm good at pricing, but it's keeping everything organized. You know, I don't want to contradict myself. I'm so organized in the workshop, but it's making sure you're organized in the office as well, keeping everything you know, in order. Is always easier, you know, even just down to just the tax man and stuff like, just getting everything perfect, just because it's just less stress, you know.
And I suppose once you've got a system in place where things are organized, then it's easier going forward. You've just got to get the system set up.
Definitely.
It seems to me like you've got a really good instinct for keeping things simple and focused. I don't mean simple in a bad way, but we had a conversation about pricing, designing and pricing.
Yeah.
And that conversation has led to me changing my process, because I've always tried to be distinctive and offer something really, what I thought was really special and a good selling point, where I would design on SketchUp in front of the customer at their house. And my theory was that once I'd refined that process, it was quicker, because I'd win the customer over, I'd have the design agreed, and then I could hit the ground running. But it didn't always work that smoothly, and I didn't always win the job. You told me about what sounds like a fairly instinctual pricing process, where you don't get too bogged down in that, and you also are able to get an idea of what the customer wants based on your past work.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that a fair summary of how work?
So starting my business quite early on, I found myself working during the day and then going to jobs in the evening, and spending quite a while with clients, you know, and I wasn't getting home till late. I was absolutely shattered. But now I've thought, you know, over the last, say, year or so, year and a half, I've actually been going to see the clients, meet them face to face, taking a quick measure up, and just say, look, I'll get back to you with some prices, and not necessarily a drawing, but an idea of what I've got planned. And then we'll exchange some ideas, because otherwise I feel like I'm going to waste hours upon hours doing drawings and sitting with people that might not actually want the service. So if I can give them straight away a ballpark figure of what things are going to cost, and show them an example of what I've built before, they know the build quality, they follow me on Instagram, they follow me on Facebook, so they know that the work should be good enough for what they want. And then you give them a ballpark figure and it works within their budget. Book them a slot, because obviously, you know, waiting lists at the moment, we've got quite a long waiting list. So at least we can get them on the waiting list. And then closer to the time, if I need to pop back maybe 2 weeks before starting the job, I can go refresh myself, because some people, you know, have their rooms plastered, they change things in there. So it's good to have a refresh of how the house looks, meet the client again, and then just go through it all. So sometimes, and it might be long-winded that you're going there twice, but if I took a full survey and sat with them, and then 6 months later, I'm then on that job, I'm just going to lose my chain of thought and everything. So at least if I go back there, I can, they might have changed their mind in that time as well. I've got a deal.
Yeah, and it's less clutter rattling around your head when you've got lots of jobs that you've designed in detail, because it takes a lot of mental energy to design something. And then, as you say, 6 months later, you've got to pick it up again and it's changed anyway. You may as well just have left it until then. You're still there, Gary. All right. Well, in case we get other technical distractions, let's just map out where we're going with the rest of this. So let's move on to the third question, which is to do with how you've invested in your model for growth.
Yeah.
And then move a bit more on to you telling us more about your bigger workshop and how things are working out for you there. Yeah. And then we did want to talk a bit about mental health as well. So we'll maybe end on that. So third question from Sean Perks, 54 Woodworks. He's on Instagram as well. He says, I think a good question to pose is around the business model that you've adopted to fund growth. No need for confidential information, but how have you invested in your company? So he says, Gary has recently invested in some fantastic premises and machinery. His recent Instagram stories show him flying through the sheet breakdown and banding process. And so he's hopefully able to optimize his business for the future. Hopefully this kind of information would be interesting to other people on earlier stages of company growth. So I guess you can take that as you want, answer that how you wish.
So I'd probably be careful how I answer this at this, because of the stage we're in with the coronavirus. So if someone was thinking about maybe getting a workshop in the next, I know you're looking to get a new work, you're in the process of getting it, but I would never want to push someone to get something if they weren't 100% confident and they had the work lined up. So obviously we took this workshop on, I found it in December and I moved in on the 1st of February. So I was pretty much, you know, it wasn't that bad in the UK, the corona. I know there was talk that it may spread over here, but obviously it's, you know, it's put us all in a situation. But, you know, things have changed in our workshop because I haven't got Ben with me anymore. So I'm pretty much doing everything on my own at the moment. So in terms of the business running smoothly, it's not, I'm half enjoying the fact that I can be on the tools because Ben probably would have been using these machines more than I would have been, because I do a lot of office work, a lot of spraying and stuff like that. So in a sense that I've been able to enjoy the workshop, but in terms of, you know, we needed to expand because we've got so much work, and me and Ben couldn't work in that little workshop, the old one, together. It was just impossible for us to do.
You were being driven by your success, weren't you? You weren't just optimistically trying to drag the business forward. No. Work was pushing you to you needed more capacity.
Yes, exactly. And obviously, you know, in terms of a business side, I feel like I've achieved, like, where we are right now. Obviously I'm hoping that the COVID coronavirus stuff will get better in the near future so we can, you know, knuckle down with the business properly. But this is as far as I want to go with my business. I love carpentry and joinery so much that I just want it to be enjoyable, as well as not having 5-10 people working for me and, you know, be bogged down with that sort of stuff. So, but yeah, so technically in the best place we could be right now without the COVID. So we'll see. So I couldn't really give too much advice in terms of making a jump. Mm. You know, I think it's been perfect for us. We're happy that we've invested in the machines and they're definitely going to improve us as a company. But in these times, I just don't know whether it'd be worth taking the risk and buying stuff if you haven't got the work lined up. So,
okay. Yeah. No, that's interesting. So there's different ways of growing a business. There's the bootstrapping method where you just invest whatever resources you've managed to build up. And then there's taking on debt finance, and then there's taking on equity finance. I was on a course learning about these things. Yeah. Debt finance, obviously, you've got to pay back. Equity finance, you're taking someone else's money in return for a share of ownership of the business because they hope to get a future return. It sounds like you're keeping control over your business. You're not getting anybody else involved. You've financed these machines, right, from the machinery supplier.
That's correct, yeah, because I didn't want to, you know, it's just a better option to pay it off monthly, because then it just sort of comes off the accounts, then it sort of thing. So
yeah, and you can assume they're going to bring extra productivity, so you're going to be making more per month, and they cover themselves, I suppose.
Yeah. And already, if we look at what we used to get done in 3 days, we're doing that in a day when we're working properly in a new workshop. So we're cutting our times of, you know, how long things used to take us. We're cutting that in, you know, taking us a quarter amount of time. So
can you identify what the biggest time savers are in how you do things now compared to before?
Well, it's definitely the cutting an edge inside and just having more space, because, you know, when just say Ben was breaking the sheets down, you know, usually if I haven't got anything to spray, you know, if I'm not drawing, then I'm sort of twiddling my thumbs. And I found myself over the last year or so, my productivity probably halved. I'm on site going to people's houses and fitting the wardrobes. Nothing stops me. I love it. I just go full steam and I work, you know, quite late, just get the jobs done. But if I'm home, if I was in the old workshop, I just felt like I was getting quite lazy. So I feel like we needed to make that step where I've got my own working space. Ben's got his own working space. Yeah. It was always going to work. So
we've compared notes before, haven't we? And we've really connected on this point. I feel now in my home workshop that used to be like my pride and joy, and I'd just be me with my radio. I grew the business, got Brady involved. So glad to have him. But now the workshop is like his domain.
Yeah.
And because I am often tied up with office work and design, when I do then go down to the workshop, he's got a system going. He's got a pile of one job there and another job there. And I feel like a fish out of water in my own workshop. And I just think, well, I'll just be getting in his way. and there's always more to, I find there's always more to do in the workshop, in the office. So I've become less and less involved in the making, which isn't entirely a bad thing, because Brady's been able to really excel in it.
Yeah.
And then, like you, I hit the installs hard and I'm absolutely in my element.
Yeah.
And I find that Brady then is a little bit of a fish out of water when he helps on the installs, because we've got used to our own methods, doing things our own way. But I'm looking forward to a bigger workspace where we've agreed I'm going to have my own workbench and Brady's going to have his own workbench. And I'm sure there'll be a bit of crossover in process and moving boards around. But if I know that I can just go to that workbench, I've got my tools there set up the way I want them, I can get straight to it. Okay, so any other information or advice? I know you're saying you don't want to be advising people to make a move, but I suppose just anything else that you've learned from your move and how things have been in a bigger space.
I think it's given me more of a professional side as well, because going back to the comment, how we first met was like, because I was working technically out of the garage, I almost had this a little bit like, oh, you know, I can't tell a client I'm working out of my garage, it looks unprofessional, that side. But even though it wasn't, because, you know, I was being as professional and my work, you know, I was always doing the best I could. But having a proper workshop and a unit, it just looks more like, if I show the client what I'm doing, it just almost just gives it a bit more of an edge. So it just gives me a bit more confidence in myself as well, how I look as a business. So, you know, and obviously the fact that I have got a very large job at the moment, which we're working on, you know, they actually approached me while I was in the old workshop. So they were confident of my ability anyway, but I think it's just given a bit more confidence. The fact that I've got all these new machines and I'm doing their work for their whole house, it just makes them feel like I'm going to be able to keep everything on schedule. But I think that's all been blown out the water at the moment anyway, because the site was closed a couple of weeks ago. I think it's still closed because obviously the COVID. So everything that's been lined up for the next few months is just take as it is sort of thing. Just as long as you're speaking to clients, you know, just, I mean, who knows?
Yeah. But you've got, you said to me, quite a few months worth of work in the bag, right? And that's not the plug pulled on it, has it? So I guess you're sorted. Yeah.
So I actually messaged, I basically set up like a template and messaged most of my clients. And I think we was actually booked up at one point for a year, which is ridiculous, really. Cause I, you know, I'm me being quite an impatient person myself. If I ever want anything done around the house, I need it done straight away. So that gave me more confidence that people wanted to wait for me. So I actually sent an email out to everyone saying, look, we're doing all we can to just get jobs done properly. And, you know, we can't guarantee these jobs are going to be done when they are. And everyone was pretty much got back to me. There was only a few that said their situation has changed, probably financially. But so many people just wanted me to want to go ahead still. So it's just a matter of just getting through the jobs when I do. And I think people are willing to wait now. That, you know, they're not just going to suddenly try and find someone, because it just means inviting more people into the house. It's, yeah, it just, you know, I've done a lot of my quotes and stuff like that already, so I'm assuming they'll just stick with me. So
yeah, well, it seems like your business has turned a corner. I mean, probably before this move, that I think you've got your reputation, people trust you. And you told me you don't even have a website, is that right? It's been mostly social media and was it Facebook groups where you got shared and recommended a lot?
So Facebook, basically, let me just tell the quick story of how. So I left my old company. I was working for them for 10 years, and all their work was in Surrey. So I left them because my wife got pregnant with twins, and I was traveling two to 2.5 hours a day to get to work, and I was absolutely exhausted. So I thought I'd need a change of scenery. So I left them and went to work for Smallbone. Smallbone Kitchens, they're sort of quite a well-known company. So I worked with them for a few months, but ironically the first job I'd done for them was in Surrey as well. So, but I knew it wasn't going to be for long. It was only going to be for a couple of weeks. So I sort of stuck it out, and I've done a lot of work in sort of Chelsea, Knightsbridge, all them sort of areas. But I was getting a few inquiries. So I grew up in Walthamstow. So I was getting a few inquiries in that sort of area. So, you know, it was great. Are you still there, Alistair?
Yeah,
so it was great that I could be working close to home and, you know, work for the people that I, you know, I grew up in that area, so it'd be nice to work for them sort of people. So and so I basically would do a job, and just how I built wardrobe, there's like a Facebook, they just share basically what people have done. And so I'll do a wardrobe, and if they're happy, they'll post on Facebook to say, oh, Gary Banks from Banks Carpentry done this wardrobe, we're really happy with it. And suddenly I'll just get 5 inquiries after that. And then it just expanded and expanded until, you know, I was on this one Facebook page, and I think I had 45 recommendations on there with all pictures and everything. So I think it was just my name was out there, which is really good for me. So yeah, so that, and now Instagram as well. You know, I get quite a lot of inquiries for Instagram. So it's just literally them two platforms that I get all my work through. Yeah. So it's worked really well.
It certainly sounds like it. So the transition that you've now made to the larger workshop, that must have come with a certain amount of stress. How do you find, you obviously love your work, you take great pride in it. Do you find any downsides to it?
Well, I'd say from December till, say, February, I was so stressed out, because obviously it was quite a big move. It was still a big outlay each month, obviously with the rent, the two new machines, the wages of Ben, you know, so it was quite stressed. But, you know, I don't necessarily regret doing it now. Well, I don't regret doing it now because I really like it there. But, Alice, I'm going to have to ask that question again. Just lost my chain of thought.
So I was it was meant to be a leading opening up question, to be honest with you, because we said we'd talk about mental health and things around that. I just thought I'd see how you'd come at that question, really, with the downsides. It's like the downsides of the business, because we all know there's stress involved in any line of work, really, and I'm interested in how that affects you and your take on it.
Well, yeah, so basically I am quite an anxious person. Probably say I suffer from anxiety, but in a different type. I'm a big worrier. I'm a big worrier of making people happy with my work and worrying about just what people, not necessarily what people think of me. I just want everything to be perfect, basically. So, you know, I've had it for months leading up to jobs. You know, have I done the right thing? Are they going to be happy with what I've designed for them? And, you know, even like the day before fitting, I'm worrying about a parking space and stuff like that. So, you know, when it comes to mental health, it's not just the pretty photos on Instagram that it's a perfect business. And, you know, I do worry a lot outside of, you know, behind the scenes, basically, just with everything, really. So And it's weird. I've actually been quite relaxed over the last couple of weeks with the whole COVID thing, which is really bizarre. But I think because it's actually something really real to worry about, that I've not been so bad.
I really relate to that. I was talking to someone about exactly that today. I sometimes feel like I'm at my best in a crisis when there is one important thing to focus on.
Yeah.
And I struggle when I've got a whole load of responsibilities and nobody's sort of dictating to me which one is the most important to focus on.
Yeah.
You've got to manage yourself. But yeah, sometimes something that brings things into focus is helpful. And I don't mean to minimize the seriousness of the current crisis, but I can relate to what you said. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just we as humans, we do adapt sometimes. We're all in the same boat. We all worry. But I think sometimes we do pull through and get through it all. So that's why I think we're all going to try and do our best over the next few months.
Yeah, and I see the woodworking community encouraging each other on Facebook, and that you've done the SketchUp live thing, and you talked to me a lot about it before, and you clearly just wanted to give people a focus, give of your time, and help them to learn something. I know you've got other plans brewing, to give back to the community, and I see. I mean, I put a post on Facebook recently. I'm not on Facebook much, and I'd logged on to it, and yet again, I found myself watching this. It was like a 7-minute long video of a car chase, and it said under it, "Watch this to the end. It's amazing," something like that.
Yeah.
And then nothing happens at the end, and I think, why did I watch this? And I put this post up saying, I don't know why I go on Facebook, because that always happens. It's just a load of nonsense. But every time I go on Instagram, I learn something or get to know somebody better. And I suppose it depends on the circle you've got, because I'm sure there's a load of rubbish on Instagram as well. But I find the woodworking community there is really good and positive. And I scroll through and I learn loads of things.
Yeah, to know people. I totally agree. And it does, like sometimes my wife says to me, what are you doing on Instagram? But it's almost like you are learning. You're seeing what people's different techniques are, and you know, there's so much interest. Like obviously, I do follow a lot of interior design stuff and carpenters, joiners, and that sort of stuff. So it's just so refreshing to have a long day at work and just sit on your phone and or on your iPad and just look through what other people have achieved and hearing their stories and what mistakes they've made, and just it's lovely. You're on Instagram, I watch your stories, and we chat on the phone as well. You know, we know a lot of this. There's actually quite a small circle in a sense that a lot of us know each other now, you know,
just through Instagram. Yes, really. you and I've never met.
No,
I've met Derek Barrett because I bought something off him, and I noticed John Jones also bought something off Derek Barrett, and it's so people are starting to meet each other off Instagram. But even when we don't, I feel like I know you really well. I count you as a friend. We can chat because we can relate as well. That's a good thing. You it's the mutual understanding of the same problems in the same line of work.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and I think it's always good for people to be reminded that everybody sometimes struggles.
Yeah.
And people that do high quality work like you do, I think we all have a tendency to see people's best on Instagram and genuinely believe that everything's perfect for them. But it's not, is it?
No.
We all struggle.
And sometimes I do feel like I want to post more about, you know, the background of what's going on. Not necessarily behind the scenes, but my day-to-day problems. I want to try and do more stories on Instagram through my day. And if I do come up with a problem, I want to post on there. So I've just cocked this up, or I've just got this wrong, or this is getting me down. I probably should do that more, because obviously I'm not pretending like everything's perfect all the time. So
it's a difficult balance, isn't it? I understand that you've got such a good reputation as well with customers.
Yeah.
It's whether you see your Instagram as customer facing, because they don't need to know the struggles. You are trying to, at the end of the day, sell a product, and you do always deliver a quality product. But then, to the extent you're engaging with other woodworkers, you can encourage them with that real life story. I have found that I've had a surprisingly positive response from customers when I've shared things, and I've got a bit of a reputation for being painfully honest.
Yeah.
And sometimes even I post something and think, I probably really shouldn't have posted that, because that's maybe going to raise real doubts about my ability. And so sometimes perhaps I go too far. But even on those things, I've had customers come back to me and say, no, we could see that. Okay, you made a mistake, but you fixed it.
Yeah.
And going right back to when I started this little business and I did a bit of market research, one of the first responses I got, I knew nothing about customer service. One of the first responses to a little questionnaire I did was people said, we understand things don't always go right or you get delayed. We just want you to communicate with us. And that's what will build trust between a customer and a tradesman is openness and honesty and fixing the problem once it's happened, not trying to cover it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's, yeah, it's not, it doesn't necessarily play as badly as we might think.
Yeah.
Letting customers see more of the background.
Yeah. Another thing is I totally agree with that because obviously, you know, I've found that working over the last couple of years, I've actually got friends through working for people. So, you know, making that friendship of, you know, you're in their house for probably know, 2 to 3 days, you're working with them for a couple of weeks, getting designs, you're talking loads. It's so nice to be able to just be on it. If you're going into the house and something is wrong, it's just easier to be honest because you always get caught out. It's pointless trying to lie. It's pointless trying to cover something up. If you're just completely honest and to say, look, this has happened and that's happened. Like I was mentioned earlier on with the spraying, I told that client what happened. I was brutally honest with them and, you know, they're obviously disappointed that it was happening, but I think they respected me that they knew what was going on rather than trying to hide it all. So, and it worked out, the job was perfect in the end. So I think I respected their trust in that way. So
it's a good feeling when customers put trust in you. I've had that. Sometimes I feel this deep gratitude. I felt that with a couple of customers that have let me back in their houses since the coronavirus thing.
Yeah.
Because and one of them was a little high risk health-wise, as is my son.
Yeah.
But they recognize that if I don't work, then I can't survive.
Yeah.
And they wanted the job done. But there was just this sort of fussy trust. You know, they didn't make a big show of it. They just seemed to trust that I would be responsible.
Yeah.
And that made me want to rise to that and go the extra mile to really keep my distance and sanitize and all that.
Yeah.
So we need our customers, don't we?
And of course.
It can become a good relationship when you play it right. Yeah.
And I've actually got I think 4 or 5 jobs stacked up in the workshop, and obviously I've got to do a lot of fitting over the next few weeks. And obviously the next client I'm working for, we've been speaking quite a lot, and you know, I've had no contact with anyone that, you know, I've had 3 or 4 meters away, the next door neighbors at in the joinery shop, but I've been in no contact. So I can give that client confidence that I'm going to wear masks and, you know, be as clean as I can and everything, but giving them confidence that I can come into their house and because they've got a newborn baby and stuff like that. So just trying to be completely honest. And that's probably the way things will go forwards, you know, just trying to be sensible about everything and keeping our hygiene. And
I sort of feel like it's an opportunity for us to raise our game yet again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think as a community across Instagram, I think we'll raise each other's game as we model good practice. So, yeah. Great. Okay. Well, I think we did it, Gary. I hope we don't listen to this back and we've got issues with the audio again.
I think there was the odd thing. I think I lost track of a question. You know, something happens sometimes. You start talking and you lose track of what you're...
That's fine.
So frustrating. But there might be one question in there that you've said, but we'll both hear it and probably be able to figure that out, won't we? But I felt quite good about that one. Did you?
I did, yes. So I'm not sure now if we're still... I think you're talking off record now, aren't you? I was sort of still talking on record.
Oh, okay.
Because I hadn't quite wrapped it up. I'm not quite sure I'm going to wrap it up now. Shall we just leave this in? Do you mind?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, leave it in. It's right. It's brutally honest then.
yeah, honestly. Go on.
No, it's been really good talking to you, Alistair. Obviously, I hope we can meet in the near future with everything going on. I'm sure we will, or do a FaceTime.
I hope so. We did plan to, didn't we? Just before this COVID thing really kicked off, you sent me what I thought was a very generous invite. We were chatting. I think we were floating the idea of doing either a podcast or like comparing our workshops on video or something. And you said, just come down and... I was really looking forward to it, but then it just became impossible. So
hopefully we'll get that in
one day. Yeah,
but also we might do a SketchUp joint video type thing, which is sort of all in the plan with a few other joiners at the moment. So we're thinking about doing that, which you were very helpful in the last live SketchUp video I'd done. Uh-huh. So I've learned a lot from you in that sense. So it'd be great if we can all work together in that as well. Little community working together.
Yes, yes, I'm up for that. So everyone listening out there, look out for news of that on Gary's page, and I'll reshare it online on Instagram. And if you're listening to this and you're not on Instagram, you've probably picked up by now that it's a really good place to be. Yeah. So get yourself over there.
Definitely.
Okay, Gary, well, have a good weekend.
Yep.
And we'll speak again before long.
Thank you very much, Alistair. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Cheers. Take care. Bye.